We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Welcome back. It is Hardline on News Radio 930 WBEN. 1 hour down, 52 minutes to go, and then it's Sunday afternoon, and hopefully the Mets won't look like they did yesterday. But joining us this segment, you know, it's April 25th. I did not know that was the date until I just looked in the corner of the screen. It's April 25th, and still, kids are not back in school full-time. To talk about that, we have Michael Cornell. He is the superintendent at Hamburg Central Schools and the president of the Erie Niagara School Superintendents Association. Mike, good morning.
Morning, Joe. How are you?
I'm doing well, Michael. Now, tomorrow, in some districts, I'm not sure if this is in Hamburg as well, we are going to see more grades go back full-time. Is that correct?
In the Hamburg Central School District, we will have our pre-K through 5 students in school, fully in person, cohorts A, B, and C, which is the vast majority of our students. I think that's true across most school districts in Western New York.
And what are the precautions? So we know that 6 feet goes to 3 feet, but what other safety measures will be in these classrooms as kids return?
Everything we've been doing since September is still going to be in place. So layering the mitigation strategies one on top of the other, as we've done. The research tells us the two most important mitigation strategies, more important than distance, are masks and airflow. So, you know, all year when I go to my classrooms, you've got windows open, you've got fans running, even when it's cold. Everybody wears their masks, and that's absolutely critical. Our mask compliance in our schools is nearly universal, and I'm on our schools every day. So all the stuff we've been doing, we're going to keep doing. We're just going from 6 feet to 3 feet, which the science says is safe.
And now there will still be, I don't know if this is at every district, but will there still be a remote option for those children whose parents want them to stay home?
Yes.
And what are you seeing? I'm not sure you can see this, the numbers, but are most students, families want them in school? Are most kids going to be back and not using that remote option?
Overwhelmingly so. So in Hamburg, we had, at the start of the year, 9 or 10% of our students were opted into the remote model, and then 90-91% of our students attended in person. That number ranges anywhere from 9% to 18 or 19% across Western New York, but the overwhelming majority of students want to be in person learning with their classmates and in the company of our great teachers. And that number hasn't moved a lot, actually. If you remember, we did it. The Erie Niagara School Superintendents Association did a survey of parents and asked how many of you would attend in person if we layered the mitigation strategies one on top of the other. And 80-some-odd percent said that they wanted their kids in person. And that number has held firm since June when we did that study.
And now that the elementary grades are getting back to school, are you hearing from parents of 6 to 12 how much they want their kids back full time? And maybe even from the students, they want to be back 5 days a week.
Well, hearing that from parents and students is not new, Joe. You know, we've been hearing that since, for months now. And in fact, it's happening in large parts of the country. As Georgetown tracks in-person learning, hybrid learning, fully remote learning across the 200 largest school districts in the country. I just looked at it this morning. And as of today, 59.8% of the 200 largest school districts are learning fully in-person pre-K through 12 every single day, and it's safe. So people look around and they see that that's what's happening, and they wonder why it's not happening in New York.
And, you know, like I said, it's April 25th. We have 2 months left, almost to the day, 2 months left in the school year. Do you have any optimism that one of these, maybe next month, we will see for the last couple of weeks, full 5 week classrooms at all grades?
You know, Joe, I don't know. I don't know if I would say I'm optimistic. I'm always hopeful. I mean, I wake up every day hopeful that we can find a way to get all of our kids in person every single day, because it's so critically important for our children for so many reasons. But, you know, I think the guidance we have in hand today is most likely the guidance that we're going to have between now and the rest of the year. I don't anticipate the New York State Department of Health of its own volition making any changes to the guidance. And most problematic in that guidance, Joe, is the use of the transmission rate matrix that's in the CDC guidance and that New York State Department of Health included in its guidance, which says that you can't have your secondary school students at 3 feet of the mask if the transmission rate in the community is more than 99 cases per 100,000 over a 7-day period. Now, despite the fact that the research around that, you know, there's plenty of research that indicates that the transmission rate in the community really doesn't have much to do with whether or not kids are safe at 3 feet or 6 feet, regardless of how old the kids are. It's in the guidance. We have to follow it. And I don't see that changing. It also does not look as though the trend line of community infections would get us below 100 cases per 100,000 over a 7-day period anytime soon either. So I think the only way that you'd have grade 6 through 12 kids in school every day during this particular school year would be if one of these court cases results in that part of the guidance being struck from the guidance. You know, if it's determined that it's arbitrary and capricious and doesn't have a basis in the science, then that would cause kids at middle school and high school to come back. But short of that, Joe, you know, I'm sad to say I don't see it happening.
Now, you know, we talk about getting back to school, and that's the number one thing, getting back to school and children's health. But, you know, end of the year, you do have those end of the year events. You know, there's always a prom. There wasn't last year. I don't know if at Hamburg or at any schools, are there any sort of end of the year events that weren't there last year that'll be there for students this year?
Yeah, I think school districts all across Western New York, I know in Hamburg, our high school administrative staff, you know, they're working with the student government kids at the high school, working with the senior class advisors to try to find a way to create these experiences for kids, which are so critically important. They're milestone experiences for children and for families. I mean, these are family accomplishments and family occasions, as you know, trying to find a way to blend together what we know we need to do to make the end of the year special for our kids. And the New York State Department of Health guidance, which we have, that's restrictive in terms of what we can really do. You know, you can have a prom, but the kids can't dance unless they dance near their table in a taped off area and rotate the dancing times, essentially is what you've got to do. You know, everybody else other than people at your table have to be 6 feet apart the whole time. So it's, you know, the guidance creates a circumstance in that type of a setting that's really unwieldy. And frankly, somewhat, you know, I don't think the kids feel like that's going to be a ton of fun either. So we're trying to find a way to, you know, try to find venues for graduation, to try to get as many kids together as possible. So I know that school districts across Western New York are working like crazy to figure it out. And great credit to our high school administrators. You know, we work with them all the time on this stuff. As district administrators, they're working with their students and the class advisors. I mean, they're busting their rear ends to try to find a way to make it special for our kids at the end of the year.
You know, so we talk, like I said, we talk a lot about this year, getting kids back to school this year. But let's fast forward to September. And let's go with the assumption that we're back school full time. Are there going to be some learning curves, right? Especially for students that have not been in a building full time for a year. Are there going to be plans for, say you're a senior, and you were doing hybrid your junior year, is there going to need to be that month to catch students up when it's back to in the classroom?
Well, before we assume, Joe, that we're going to be back full time, I think we have to acknowledge that there may be, you know, some conversation this summer about whether or not we should go back full time, which I think would be totally inappropriate. Like, I just want to put it out there, Joe, that if we don't prioritize getting our students back, pre-K through 12, every single day, then we have failed our kids. You know, so I think we need to say that first. The New York State Department of Health needs to find a way to make sure we prioritize getting our kids back 100% every single day in September. That has not been the priority since the beginning of COVID. It's not the priority today on April 25th as we sit here. Lots of other things have been prioritized over having our kids back full-time in school. So before we just assume we're going to be back full-time, I think we need to see something or hear something from the New York State Department of Health that tells us unequivocally that they're going to prioritize having our kids back pre-K through 12 every single day in September. I've not seen that yet in writing. I think we need to see it as soon as we can. It's absolutely imperative. It's a moral imperative.
Did you, I gotta ask you to look back a year ago. Did you think we would be here April 25th, 2021, still talking about not having K through 12 in school full time?
It was March 15th, Sunday night, 28, 29 school superintendents all in a room in Erie One BOCES when we made the decision ourselves as a group to close schools for until after the spring break. And in that moment, we believe we're coming back after spring break. You know, little did we know or anybody else know that we'd still be sitting here asking ourselves the same question, when are we going to come back? But it's worth noting, in much of the rest of the country, that's already a decided question because they've been back, you know, 3 feet in a mask and doing it safely for many, 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 many months. And school has been safe around the country. So it just seems like in New York, we've had a particularly difficult time prioritizing full-time in-person instruction, whereas other states have found a way to do it.
Let me ask you this. I know it's a issue of private record, but we're talking a lot about COVID hesitancy in the community. Have you heard of COVID vaccine hesitancy amongst teachers in any districts?
Well, I mean, I think our workforce mirrors the workforce of every other industry, right? I mean, we're a reflection of society, so you've got some people who are early to want to go get vaccinated. I'm sure we have others who are less anxious to go do it. I would guess the majority of school workforces around Western New York have been vaccinated by this point. The New York State Department of Health did prioritize vaccinating school staff, which we thought was a step towards prioritizing fully in-person learning. But we kind of stopped short of it. We prioritized vaccinating school staff, but then that was it. Then we stopped prioritizing in-person learning. But to answer the question you asked me earlier, Joe, about what do we do in September, that's why getting the kids in school every day now is so important. So we've got 8 weeks to see where our youngest learners really are. Where are they in terms of their progression on literacy and numeracy? You know, where are they in terms of building those academic skills? But most importantly, Joe, it's about reconnecting kids to their love of learning. You know, kids have to love learning. Kids have to love school. And it's our job to make sure that at those early grades, we make sure they build the skills of literacy and numeracy and make sure they love school and feel efficacy for themselves as learners. And when kids are learning, just, you know, in person a couple days a week, then they're not in person. I mean, they're still learning, but it's just not the same because learning is a social experience. It's a social activity. It's done best when they can do it together with their classmates, all their classmates, every single day in the company of our great teachers. We have great teachers all across Western New York. We have great teachers in Hamburg. And our kids need to be with their teachers every day. Not only is that the way learning happens best, it's developmentally the most appropriate way for them to learn.
This might seem like an obvious question, but do you think there will be students that who have been out of the school, you know, half a year, not full time, that are going to have to either repeat a grade or go to summer school next year?
Well, I think we have to be careful about how we talk about that, Joe. Here's the reality. Those, you know, in a broad sense, there are certain skills that are, you know, most likely and developmentally to be developed at certain times in a child's life. But every child learns at a different pace. You know, we find ways to put kids in first grade, second grade, third grade, according to age. But developmentally, kids are always in a different spot, even though they're in third grade. They're developmentally in different places. They're academically in different places. So we've always had to acknowledge that in school. So the question that we have to ask ourselves is not, you know, is Johnny ready for third grade or is Johnny ready for algebra? The question is, what are our algebra teachers and our third grade teachers going to make sure they do to be ready for the kids who come to us, regardless of what the impact of COVID has been? So I think that's what I hear from the educator. That's not me saying, hey, educators, this is what you need to do. This is educators telling me, as an educator, as a superintendent, that's the work that they're going to be focused on. You know, what do I need to do to make sure that I'm ready for the kids who are going to come to me? And what they also tell me is that's always the work. You know, that's the work of public education. You know, we take every child who comes to us. We take them as we are. We love them as they are. We teach them as we are. And we take them as far as they can go and make sure they get everything they need. So, you know, that's always been the work of public educators, and it'll continue to be the public educators, even as we emerge from the hybrid learning or whatever model of learning kids have been in. In September, we take them as they are, we love them as they are, we teach them as they are, and you know, we give them everything they need.
Michael, I appreciate you joining me on a Sunday. I'm sure we will have you on again very soon.
Okay, good talking to you, Joe. Have a good day.
Thanks, you too. That's Michael Cornell, superintendent of Hamburg Central Schools, also the president of the Erie Niagara School Superintendents Association. All right, a few days ago, Brian Mazurowski and myself, on a show called Be Maz and Beamer, talked to Amish Adalija from Johns Hopkins, and he talked about what it's like, what it means to kids to be isolated, some for over a year now without going to school. And here is a little bit of that interview.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. It's legitimate for parents to be worried about how a new infectious disease impacts children. But what we've seen throughout this pandemic is a lot of data accrue that show that children are generally spared the severe consequences of this disease, and they're not necessarily the major spreaders of infection the way they are with influenza. It's a very different disease even than influenza, where you see a bigger mortality hit in children and more epidemiological spread related to children. And that data has accrued over this pandemic, and I think it's become clear that many of the decisions that were made for children were really COVID-centric and not overtaking the overall health of the child, the psychosocial development, educational needs, other risks that may happen, mental health. All of that needed to be thought about, especially in children, because they're so vulnerable when you try to think about, you know, how to adapt your behaviors because of COVID-19. And thankfully, children are a group where I think you can be a lot more flexible and we have a lot more room, especially as more and more adults are vaccinated.
Yeah, doctor, speaking of that, adults are being vaccinated and the main risk is children passing it on to older family members. What are we seeing with kids that have been out of school now, some for over a year of physical schooling? What are those other health consequences when you're looking at just COVID-19? What are the other health consequences from keeping kids out of the classroom and out of those social settings?
So first of all, we know that they're not learning as efficiently as they would in the classroom. And I'm not a pediatrician, but so I'm going to talk in more generalities. We know that children need social interaction for their psychosocial development, that helps their overall well-being. And it's really something that is interlocked with how they grow to be adults, to be healthy adults. And what's happened is there's been really deprivation that's been going on for these children and some of the parents where there might have been really aggressive worry about COVID-19 or in places where they weren't able to go to schools or weren't able to go to playgrounds. All of that has a toll and we'll pay for that eventually. We even see health benefits in terms of childhood vaccinations. They went down during the height of the lockdown. So our protection in our children against diseases like measles, where you in New York State had a major outbreak a couple of years ago, all of that has to be taken into account. And we have to not kind of trade the short-term the short-term gains from a COVID perspective against the long-term issues. So I think that's happened in general throughout this pandemic, that there was a lot of prioritization of the short-term over the long-term and not much long-range principle thinking of what's sustainable and what's not sustainable. And I do think now it really is incumbent on every school district to open. We have the data. We have the ability to do this safely. We've had that data for some time. And now we have a lot of teachers that are vaccinated, the vast majority of them. There's really no excuse not to have the at least the pedagogical part of school, sitting in school, learning about algebra and math and reading. Sports are a little bit different. It's a little bit more difficult to do because there's more risk of transmission than actually sitting in a desk. But the actual core function of schools is to teach children, and I think that needs to start immediately. It should have started a long, long time ago in many school districts around the country.
We mentioned you're quoted in the New York Times in an article posted today, and this kind of stuck out to me because it applies to what we're talking about, but then it can also apply to so much more. And you said it's really important to look at a child's overall health rather than a COVID-only perspective. And for much of the last year, I compared it to like the Budweiser Clydesdales, and you see them walking around, but they got those blinders on the side. So they're not distracted by anything else. They're only focused on the task at hand. And in a large part, we've all been kind of wearing that because it is an important task to handle this, to manage it, and to try and best get rid of COVID as best we can. But outside of schools and in kind of our everyday life, have you seen that approach make an impact that was not intended in other areas?
Definitely, and it's not just in children. We know, for example, that cancer screenings like colonoscopies and mammograms, those went down during the pandemic. We know that people delayed care for many other reasons. I work a little bit in an emergency department in the Pittsburgh suburbs, and all of a sudden there just weren't patients there with abdominal pain or chest pain or stroke symptoms. We don't know where those people went. Those diseases still continue to occur. And I think that in general, what happens during a pandemic is that there is, you know, you've got politicians and policymakers who are looking at the task at hand, and they're not thinking about long-term consequences because they're scared. They don't know what to do. They're worried about their constituency. They need to be, they're worried about staying in office. All of that's going to create this kind of incentive to think short-term at the task at hand and not think about these other consequences, which they think they can kind of kick down the road. And that's what's happened with COVID-19. So we've seen, for example, there was an article today about how bad HIV care was disrupted during the pandemic. We'll pay for all of that in the future, but it's just because it didn't happen all acute all at once the way COVID-19 was, it doesn't have the same impact on people's minds. And I think that's something we have to get better with the next infectious disease emergency we face. We have to think more long range. We have to think about what's sustainable and what isn't sustainable, and really remember that we still have to continue to function as a society, even with there's a pandemic. We can do both things. There's not this false alternative where you let COVID-19 run rampant on the one hand, or you have a Wuhan-style lockdown forever, or a New Zealand-Australia type of model forever. That's not the alternative. The alternative is something like Taiwan. We need to have a public health infrastructure that can test, trace, isolate, and vaccinate in a way that allows us to be able to go about our activities safely, not with less worry about this virus. And I think that was lacking for most of the United States. And it's really because the government failed. And it was government failure after government failure after government failure, starting in January, with basically large-scale evasion from the highest levels of government about what this meant, taking the wrong action.
That was Dr. Ramesh Adalija from Johns Hopkins joining Brian Mazurowski and myself on a little show called BMaz and Beamer. You can catch it weekdays 9 to 10. Joining us next is Dave Leventhal from Business Insider. But first, a check of the news.
Well, selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back. Basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Welcome back. Final segment here on Hardline on News Radio 930 WBEN. And as always, it is great to be joined by Dave Leventhal from Business Insider. Dave, happy Sunday. Good morning.
And a happy Sunday to you, Joe Beamer.
Well, I have to say, there's so much politics. You know, this might be the first Hardline in a while that all four segments were four different topics. Now, with Dave, we're going to talk about a lot of topics, but I don't think we'll be talking schools, the New York governor's race, and speed zone cameras in the city of Buffalo. So, I mean, all different topics covered today on Hardline. And Dave, the first question I got to ask is something we had in our bottom of the hour news, Joe Biden's first 100-day polling numbers.
Yeah, they're coming out, multiple polls, and showing that he's definitely doing better than Donald Trump was doing at this time 4 years ago in Trump's presidency, but historically not doing as great as some Republican presidents or Democratic presidents have done, again, at this time through the first 100 days. So that's not at all surprising, Joe, because the electorate is still incredibly divided. We're coming off an incredibly polarizing election. And when you add that all up, it would be truly shocking if Joe Biden's numbers had gone through the roof, if he was at, you know, say 70% or 75% approval rating. But it's kind of a victory of sorts for him in that he's doing better than he could be doing. If he was at 45% or 40%, that would be a huge indication that not only Republicans, who generally do not like Joe Biden, but also some Democrats were not real thrilled about Joe Biden. That's not the case. And almost in a way, the biggest constituency that Joe Biden has to worry about right now is not Republicans, but progressives in his own party, people on the far left, the real liberals among liberals. And he's been able to, at least in large quarters, been able to gather them in and be able to at least satisfy some of their concerns during his presidency and not alienate them in a way that was going to hurt him politically. That's what we're seeing really from these polls.
You know, Dave, as someone in Washington, D.C., I have to ask you, we talk about how divided this country is politically almost on a daily basis. Do you think someone who looks at these numbers, someone who lives and breathes and everything politics, do you think that we will ever see the day where a president can get much above a 50% approval rating?
Yeah, in politics, we're so steeped in the moment, and news is coming at you so fast, and these past couple of years have just been so disorienting in so many different ways, politically, economically, health-wise, of course, given the COVID pandemic, and we've been living really for the past decade plus in a pretty polarized time, but if you go back to, say, 1984, I mean, Ronald Reagan, he won 49 out of 50 U.S. states. Now, are we, when he won the presidential election that year, are we going to return to that type of unanimity around the country? I doubt any time soon, but it's very difficult to predict what the political ebbs and flows are going to be over the next 20 or 30 years. So I think this is one of those situations where you can never say never, even if over the next few years, things are probably going to remain largely the same.
Now, Dave, I saw a story this weekend. I didn't understand it, so obviously I have to ask you because I know you'll understand it and you'll be able to explain it to me, and I'll feel very intelligent on the topic. And that is
giving me too much credit here, Joe.
This is the passage of a 51st state. I believe it's either passed or been introduced in Congress to make Washington D.C. a 51st state. What's going on?
Yeah, so the U.S. House did pass a measure to make Washington, D.C. the 51st state. The bill now goes to the U.S. Senate, where its prospects are decidedly more dim. And if you're a betting person, you should probably bet hard against D.C. becoming, at least in this congressional term, a U.S. state. The votes just don't simply seem to be there in the Senate, where you not only need 50 votes, but because of the filibuster, you need 60 votes in this case to go ahead and push forward that bill. Were it to go forward, and the Senate did something very surprising and actually pass that bill, then Joe Biden, were it to go to his desk, would likely sign it. He's indicated and telegraphed that he would sign a bill to make D.C. the 51st state. But really, here it's just kind of two, you know, major issues, overriding issues that are part of this debate. On one side, you have most Democrats, almost all Democrats, really, who are involved saying that this is an issue of fairness and this is an issue of disenfranchising voters. So, you know, I live here in Washington, D.C., in the District of Columbia, the city itself. And if I look across my street, I'm looking out my window right now, Joe, and I see the state of Maryland. We're literally 200 feet from it. And if you live 200 feet away from where I am right now, you have a representative in Congress who's voting for you. You have two senators who are voting for you. Here in Washington, D.C., we have neither. So there are 750,000 odd people who live in the District of Columbia, which is more than several small U.S. states, such as Wyoming, for example. And we don't have votes in Congress as residents of Washington, D.C. The flip side of that is many Republicans are arguing very strongly that, hey, Washington, D.C., most everyone here in Washington, D.C. is a Democrat or a Democratic-leaning independent. So their argument is that this is just a political power play. And if Washington, D.C. becomes a state, it's going to be a Democratic state for decades and decades and decades, which means two new Democratic senators always and a new Democratic House member. So the political calculus of all of this very much comes in play, and not just the taxation without representation, which literally appears on the D.C. license plate as part of the argument on the other side.
Has there been a counteroffer, right? Like, have Republicans said, if you want senators, let's make the district part of a Virginia congressional district or a Maryland congressional district? Has that been floated out there, or is it really just this idea and we either love it or we hate it?
It has been floated out there, and this is kind of an intriguing twist in all of this. Mitt Romney, for example, the Utah senator, Republican, very moderate by Republican standards, has kind of backed an idea of having the District of Columbia, the city of Washington, D.C., become part of the state of Maryland, thereby giving it representation that many people in the district want. Now, the counter argument, especially from the leadership of Washington, D.C., which has its own mayor, has its own city council, effectively saying, well, D.C. is not Maryland, and D.C. has a very different culture. It has a very different history, and like any other state, it should stand alone and not be subsumed by Virginia or Maryland. If you really want to dig deep into history, part of Washington, D.C. back in the 1800s did become part of the state of Virginia. And that's what we now know is sort of the Arlington-Alexandria area, part of that. So there is some historical precedent if you really want to go back deep into the history books, but not any modern day analogy. That seems to be a non-starter, becoming part of Maryland, but it definitely is an offer out there for at least some Republicans who are willing to entertain a compromise of that sort, Joe.
All right, the last question I'll ask you on this. I'm sure you didn't think you were going to get this many questions about the 51st state. Are there any Democrats, you know, I think of Joe Manchin when I think of Democrats that might not be leaning with the party. Are there any Democrats that don't support this or have signaled they won't support this?
They are almost in lockstep supporting it. Joe Manchin is always the wild card here. And Joe Manchin, if you're not familiar with him, senator from West Virginia, definitely the most conservative, again, relatively speaking, among Democrats in the U.S. Senate. And somebody also, too, who has been steadfast against getting rid of the Senate filibuster, which makes that magical 50-vote number a magical 60-vote number. He's been very, very set against getting away and doing away from the filibuster, as many Democrats would like to do in order, in their opinion, to push a Democratic agenda, and something that they would, of course, very much like to do themselves. So, yeah, you know, Joe Manchin is going to loom large over this debate about D.C. statehood, or any debate, really, that's going to be coursing through Congress. But, you know, the Democrats are going to need more than just Joe Manchin at this point. They're really going to need some Republicans to come over to their side for D.C. statehood to become reality in the next 2 years. But we're not talking about, you know, beyond that. The Senate were to go more Democratic in the future, then we have a very different conversation that we're going to be having.
All right, Dave, I have to, you know, I'm looking at what's going on in D.C. And, you know, again, with COVID going on, some stories you get for a week or so and then you stop following them. And I got to ask you, what is going on with Congressman Matt Gaetz?
So very much, although it's been quite in a holding pattern right now. The Florida congressman is about, you know, in the whitest hot spotlight for all the wrong reasons that you could possibly have for a member of Congress. We know that he is under active investigation by the Justice Department as to whether he engaged or was involved in sex trafficking involving potentially, allegedly, reportedly a 17-year-old. He denies that he's done anything wrong in this regard, but also the U.S. House separately has opened an investigation not only into that, but also into Matt Gaetz's conduct as a congressman, whether he's violated campaign finance rules, whether he's been quite literally showing pictures of naked women on the U.S. House floor. So these are areas that, while they might not rise to the level of criminality, also could violate House rules and put him in peril for sanctions or even expulsion, if it got to that point, for his conduct as a congressman in the U.S. House. So he's having a pretty difficult run here, and his future is incredibly hazy. We've done a ton of reporting around this issue and wrote a story recently, one of my colleagues here in the Business Insider D.C. Bureau, about how this is not a new thing for Matt Gaetz, how even and we talked to dozens and dozens of people who've known him, even going back to high school classmates, who said there's been a pattern of this going back years. So, yeah, he's not going to resign, so he says. He is not leaving office, so he says, but he's definitely got a lot of things that are not in his control going to at least in part determine his future as a politician, as an elected representative and leader. And also, if you want to play it out to its extent, a free man.
Now, this might have been a week or two ago, but was there not a Venmo link to this story?
There was, and there's all these crazy twists and turns, including one of his friends and associates who is in even greater legal jeopardy than him for sex-related allegations. And there had been a series of payments made between the two men on the Venmo financial app, which, if you've never used it, it's a little weird in the sense that you can publicly let people know how you're spending your money. And there were all these sorts of different weird memo items and messages sent back and forth that sort of indicated that there may have been financial transactions related to sexual type things. So yes, that's absolutely in the mix here. Another just bizarre twist and bizarre turn that's been part of this ongoing, now weeks-long saga involving Matt Gaetz.
And Dave, we know you will keep us updated at Dave Leventhal and at Politics Insider. Going back to D.C., and, you know, we hear this all the time, right? We hear during campaigns, infrastructure, infrastructure, infrastructure. And then once the campaign's over, you never hear about the infrastructure. Well, we have heard about certain infrastructure plans this week, correct?
We have, and in this is going to be one of those times where instead of infrastructure just dying off and you hear about it and then never hear about it again, this is going to dominate the policy discourse, to get away from the salacious stuff here for a second. The hardcore nuts and bolts policy discourse of 2021 is absolutely going to be dominated by talk of infrastructure. And the question I get from people so often when you talk about infrastructure is, well, okay, what does infrastructure actually mean? And that's really the debate, Joe, that we're having here in Washington, D.C., as to what the definition of infrastructure is going to be in terms of putting money behind it. Republicans generally would like to see a much more narrow definition of infrastructure as part of a multi-billion or multi-even trillion-dollar bill that's being now pushed forward in Congress. They'd like to see it focused on roads. They'd like to see it focus on bridges, on highways, maybe train travel. But you know, sort of the basic trappings of physical infrastructure. And Democrats, by and large, would like to see the definition of infrastructure expanded to not only just include all the things I just mentioned, but also broadband internet, different types of communication. You could be talking about infrastructure in the most liberal and broadest terms than Democrats are right now. So that's why you see Republicans arguing for something that's going to be measured in the hundreds of billions of dollars for a big infrastructure package, and Democrats are arguing for something that's going to be much bigger, maybe even exponentially bigger, in the at minimum $2 trillion level, and some Democrats, although they're not going to get their way, would like to see it even be bigger than that. So, you know, there's definitely room for compromise here, and there almost certainly will be compromise. Joe Biden himself has said that there will almost certainly have to be compromise, but this is going to be a protracted, months-long debate that isn't going to have a clear resolution, likely until, I would say, the fall at minimum, if not beyond that, Joe.
All right, Dave, this week you had former President George Bush in the news and former President Donald Trump in the news. And it made me think this. They really symbolize two factions of the Republican Party. And our first guest today, Joel Giambra, who is running for governor of New York, said that, you know, the Republican Party is moving too far to the right, and it will never win in New York, and that members of the Republican Party have to separate themselves from Donald Trump. So I'm asking you, in D.C., is there any sign of, A, that being the belief of Republicans in D.C., and any Republicans starting to separate themselves from Donald Trump as we get to the 2022 election?
Yes, there are some. Are they a majority? Heck no. Are they a very small minority at this point? Yes. At this point in time, Joe, the vast majority of Republicans remain on Team Donald Trump and support Donald Trump, would like to see Donald Trump be president right now instead of Joe Biden be president. So until there is some sort of seismic change, something that happens in the Republican Party to cause Donald Trump to lose his perch as the leader of the Republican Party, which for all intents and purposes he very much is right now, then Donald Trump is still going to dominate Republican Party politics. He's doing so right now from Mar-a-Lago, his resort and residence in Florida. We actually just reported in an exclusive that he's going to be turning his base of operations starting next month up to Bedminster, New Jersey, where he has a golf club. So that's going to sort of become the physical epicenter capital of Republican Party politics, at least for the summer months, before he moves back down to Florida again in true snowbird fashion. But the Republicans who, like Joel Giambra, like a few members in the House who, for example, voted to convict Donald Trump for impeachment charges, or who voted in the House to impeach him, they are definitely a very, very small minority right now. So I would not expect that to change dramatically over the next few months. What could be the biggest impetus for change is if Republicans get their clocks clean during the midterm elections in 2022. Now, is that going to happen? Is that not going to happen? Who knows at this point? But that, in a way, would be just a, you know, sort of a double knockout punch for Republicans if they lost bigger in 2022 than they did in 2020 when Republicans definitely did lose a lot. They lost the Senate and they lost the White House, even if they were able to claw back at least some seats in the U.S. House, but still don't have that.
All right, Dave, last question. Who do the Bills take in the draft next week?
Oh, man, you're catching me flat foot. I think they're going to take a running back in the first round.
You and I are in agreement. I also think a running back in the first round.
That seems to be an obvious missing piece. I mean, who knows? Maybe they go and take a punter or something crazy in the first round. But I doubt it. I think they're going to go running back. I think they're going to double down on offense.
All right, Dave. Well, you know, I talk to you before you go on with Susan Bryan every Tuesday, so it'll definitely be something we're talking about.
Well, we're going to know pretty soon, Joe.
That's right. Dave, thank you so much for joining me on a Sunday. Really appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you.
Dave Leventhal from Business Insider. Thank you, everyone, for joining me. Thank you, Joel Giambra, Rashid Wyatt, Michael Cornell, and Dave Leventhal. Thank you for listening. If you missed any of the show, it's on demand at WBEN.com and on the Odyssey app. Don't forget, get your day started with us tomorrow, starting with A New Morning with Susan Rose and Brian Mazurowski. BMAZ and Beamer, 9 to 10. Bellavia, 10 to 2. Tom Bowerly, 2 to 6, and Tom Puckett, 6 to 7. Have a great Sunday, everyone. We'll talk to you tomorrow here on WBEN.